It's December, so the games are like Trump on Air Force One, coming thick and fast. In Manchester, United host Arsenal in a game as entertaining as that dog sprinting on to save a goal in Argentina, although not quite at the same high technical level. At Molineux, it's Wolves handing Chelsea another defeat, while at Wembley there's a bow for Saints' new manager Ralf Hasenhüttl. There's so much more to talk about as we round up all the midweek games and look forward to the weekend's action. We talk Chelsea's bubble bursting, my langoustine hell, and more in this not award-winning, totally football show in association with Paddy Power. Listener, your ear's the only award we'll ever need. And in the pod today for them, Tom Williams.
Hello.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, James.
Author of Do You Speak Football?
Indeed.
Excellent. David Priest, goalkeeper, podcaster, friend. Nice to have you back, David.
It's nice to be back. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It certainly has.
I've been banished away with the under-18s.
Read
for a
nothing
few months.
Into that. Duncan Alexander from Opta, but not Opta no good.
Well, not at this exact moment.
No. All right. Well, a big round of games since we last were with you. What did you make of the midweek round, Tom?
Very interesting. Very fun. All Premier League teams scoring in a match week for the first time, Duncan, since
November 2010.
November 2010.
Although they didn't technically all score, did they?
Well, are we talking own goals?
Yeah, we are.
I'm not sure that's worth
it. No, but with the stats, does that still count?
Well, it counts as a team goal. Mourinho might beg to differ on these things, but yeah, generally it would count.
Okay, well, that's important. Any other conclusions?
Well, I think one of the conclusions is that increasingly we look like we're looking at a two-horse title race and a three-horse race for the remaining Champions League places. There's now a six-point gap between Liverpool in second and Tottenham in third, and then between Arsenal in fifth and Everton in sixth, there's an eight-point gap. So the table is starting to coalesce into some sort of form.
Absolutely. All right. What kind of form? We'll be talking about that in today's show. Big game midweek was at Old Trafford. Man United, Arsenal. Duncan, you were all over this.
I watched the game, yes.
Right, okay.
It was, as many people have pointed out, quite an odd edition of Manchester United v Arsenal. I mean, for people that remember, this used to be the biggest game every season in the Premier League. And it was kind of reminiscent of that Aston Villa Forest game from last week, where, you know, two former heavyweights slugging it out with maybe not that much quality, but it was very entertaining. Mourinho rolled the dice, as he often does, has now made 46 changes to his starting 11 this season, which is unsurprisingly more than any other team. It was to and fro.
Seven changes here. The big news being Pogba and Lukaku stuck back on the bench, where they were able to read at their leisure Mourinho's programme notes, which included the line, "There isn't space for people that are not ready to give their all." What did he make of the team without them?
Yeah, Pogba probably worked as hard trying to get the ball back on the bench as he did on the pitch sort of at the weekend. I don't think there was any sort of clamour for his inclusion. He should have been dropped. Same with Lukaku. It was a big, bringing Rojo back in. I mean, it was, you said it was a throw of a dice, Duncan, but it was like, it was fighting talk. It was him just stripping down to his waist and just coming out and just saying, you know, offering everyone for a fight, really.
Why does Rojo represent
Well, just because he hadn't played for, was it 202 days or something like that, he hadn't played since, and he's not the most stable defender at the best of times. And that's another thing about this game. The defending was absolutely awful.
Mm. All four goals the result of individual errors. Is that fair?
I'd say so.
De Gea failing to control that header, the Mustafi header at the start. What was that about?
Yeah, I mean, the first Arsenal goal, Mustafi header, which De Gea kind of did a low-altitude Pickford, sort of fumbled it. But even then, Herrera still had a reasonably good chance to get it off.
He's only got little legs, though, hasn't he?
Yeah, but he kind of waited for it to drop, which seemed a bit strange. He could have just headed it or even chested it away, but he didn't. And then United equalised soon after.
All right, then, so Herrera, who's actually offside, crosses for Martial while presumably the Arsenal players were looking at him thinking, well, he's offside, were they?
Yeah, they looked a little bit nonplussed, but I mean, it was still a good finish from Martial. I mean, ironically, the best goal of the night, probably, in terms of technique.
It was the only completely non-rubbish goal. I mean, the other three goals could all have been included on this season's
comedy
own goals and gaffes Christmas DVDs had they not been scored in early December.
Well, let's talk about Arsenal going back in the lead then with Lacazette, or was it Rojo's goal?
Yeah, well, Lacazette is surging through the heart of the United penalty area after United have given the ball away just inside inside their own half, and Marcus Rojo, as is often his wont, launches himself into a desperate last-ditch challenge and succeeds only in towing the ball past his own goalkeeper. I thought when I first saw it that he'd actually kicked the ball onto Lacazette's foot, but it has gone down as a Rojo own goal.
Okay. It has. Okay. And then Lingard, just 74 seconds later...
13 seconds after the restart.
Right, okay, sorry, yeah. So,
well, no, the same thing.
Yeah, but anyway.
Yeah, so Waltz is through, there's a succession of passes, and then the Arsenal defence decide just to give up defending.
Well, really. It's their ball.
And yeah, Kolasinac, it's typical of what's happening in football at the moment, where, you know, players are taking a little bit more of a chance and playing more football and trying to stay in control of the ball rather than just clearing it. In that situation, he's coming across, he's clearly winning the ball, just clear out for a throw-in, but he's not going to get anything out of trying to keep possession there. And then, yeah, there's miscommunication. Leno doesn't know whether he's going to come out with it. Kolasinac is wanting him to come out for the ball. Lingard just nips in and finishes it.
Yeah.
And then even after that, we had the sight of Lacazette trying to head the ball. We did head the ball out of De Gea's hands.
Alex Wilcock's asking, should Lacazette's cheeky goal have been allowed?
Well, the commentator at the time obviously likened it to the Gary Crosby, Andy Dibble, Forest City one back in the 90s, which, if you remember, that counted, but led to a furore afterwards, and they changed the rules.
So, it's now, so what is the rule now?
It's ungentlemanly conduct.
If you head the ball out of a
man's
but
hands.
But if the goalkeeper is bouncing the ball and you intercept it, in its bounce between...
There was one at Blackburn a few years back, Thierry Henry, and I think Brad Friedel maybe, and Friedel was going to punt the ball downfield, threw the ball up out of his hand, and Henry just knocked it off his foot and scored. And by the letter of the law, goalkeeper hasn't got the ball in both hands. It's not in his control. Henry scored. But again, as a consequence of that, I think the rules were... I'm not sure the rules were amended necessarily, but it was ruled out for that precise reason.
The goalkeeper is in control of the ball. That's why it was changed, because it's not like he just threw it aimlessly in the end.
Gordon Banks?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but exactly. I think
the only time you can do it is when, if the keeper just throws the ball on the ground.
Yeah, of course you can do it then. Yeah, of course, yeah.
And like it happened to Aurelio Gomez.
Yeah.
It happened to Shea Given as well. It was Robbie Keane, yeah.
I see. It's a shame though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, everyone agrees.
Keeper's hands.
Everyone agrees that goalkeepers get too much protection, and that's just one other example of it. I think unless the keeper's got the ball in both hands, it should be fair game. Go in there, get a touch.
Yeah, and it would have been the perfect winner. It's
a free for all
for that game. An iconic winner for an iconic match.
Absolutely. A winner, something Arsenal haven't had at Old Trafford in how long?
2006. Since the iPhone was invented.
Nice perspective on that. If Arsenal's first goal showed Man United having problems with De Gea, Guendouzi with with Marouane Fellaini. What an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, you felt that Fellaini, as a man formerly of long hair, knew exactly what this would do.
Do you think that's why he cut it?
Possibly, yeah.
To deny any recourse to...
Yeah, I mean, there have been some examples of players being suspended for hair pulling.
I remember Peter Crouch against Trinidad and Tobago. Do you remember that?
Yep. Ian Wright did it to Reggie Blinker in the 90s. Got a 3-game ban. So it's possible. I don't know, did the referee see it? Because that's the big thing.
No,
you can
I don't
be
think he did.
Retrospectively punished. No. But yeah, he could be looking at a ban for it.
Wow. And that's Fellaini. They can ill afford to do without him. All right, well, at the weekend, Arsenal will be hosting Huddersfield, whilst at Old Trafford, Fulham are the visitors. We'll talk about that game after this.
You're listening to The Totally Verbal Show with James Richardson.
Yeah, that's the Sugar Babes, fresh out of producer Ben's cupboard, with Hole in the Head. Their number one hit, Duncan, in 2003, which was last time Fulham won at Old Trafford. Yeah. Scorers were Lee Clark, Steed Malbronk, what a great name that was, and Junichi Inamoto. How about that? Let's talk a little bit about their prospects of repeating that success this coming weekend. Tom and David, you both went to Craven Cottage.
We did.
On, what was that, Wednesday night. Was it? Obviously, it was Ranieri's first clash with Leicester since leaving that club. Was it nice? Was it emotional? What was your highlight?
Well, it's hard to detect that sort of emotion from the press box. I mean, Ranieri wrote some very nice programme notes where he paid tribute to Vichai, Srivadana Prabha, and spoke about his influence at Leicester and him being the architect of the fairy tale. He got a decent reception from the Leicester fans. They were singing his name at the end and there was a little wave as he went off the pitch. But he made a point of saying in his press conference afterwards, you know, yes, it's very emotional for me coming up against Leicester, doubly so after the events of the end of October. But he said he'd managed to put those thoughts from his mind at the start of the game and kind of, you know, focus on his new job of steering Fulham out of trouble.
Right. And they're still very much in trouble, still bottom of the table, but moving in the right direction now.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the sticks that was used to beat Slavisa Jokanovic was that he didn't know his best defence. I mean, he changed his defensive setup in every game, pretty much, and with the consequence that Fulham had the worst defensive record in the division. Ironically, Claudio Ranieri has used the same defensive setup in each of his three matches, and it was the defence that Jokanovic used in his last game as manager at Liverpool, and that was also the game when Callum Chambers played in front of the back four for the first time. So you could almost say that Jokanovic did ultimately settle on the defensive system that worked, but by then it was too late and he was already set for the sack. Fulham beat Southampton in their first game 3-2, but Ranieri interestingly said that he was more enthused by their performance at Chelsea last weekend, where they won 2-0, but it was 1-0 for quite a long time and they were, you know, definitely in the game second half. I saw signs of improvement against Leicester with that midfield screen of Chambers and Jean-Michel Seri. They look a bit more solid. They're still a little bit sloppy at the back. They were a bit attentive at a few set pieces, but they seem to have a bit more about them now. Went ahead just before half time and generally succeeded in keeping Leicester at bay second half, but then Claude Puel made a couple of changes. Okazaki, Damari Gray came on. They combined to set up the equaliser for James Maddison. In the end, I think a draw was about fair, but from sort of Fulham fans that I spoke to, that, you know, I think there's a feeling that Ranieri is, you know, looks like he's turning a corner with them.
What do you think of their chances of springing some sort of surprise away at Old Trafford?
No chance. I think as long as they keep playing Odoi, Dennis Odoi, I think they're always going to struggle.
Really?
Yeah, I think he's a massive weak link in their back four. I'm surprised. I've not seen much of Callum Chambers, to be honest, but I was quite surprised by him last night. He looks a really good footballer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
Schmeichel made an absolutely wonderful save from him. Sort of, it was like a half volley, sort of hip height, dropped him from a corner.
In so Odoi, he's now operating Odoi knockdown.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's now operating as a kind of DM, is he?
Yeah.
Yeah, and yet, actually, he gets forward quite a lot. Yeah. I saw some stat the other day that he'd had more shots on target than any other Fulham player in recent
really
matches.
He wants to let go. As soon as he gets around the box, he looks really willing
to
shoot.
He had a great run against Chelsea when he beat sort of three players and then put a ball straight out for a throw-in, so it didn't end that well. But yeah, he's looking quite good going forward.
Well, I remember, I think he'd just arrived at Arsenal and he played in the Emirates Cup in that pre-season friendly tournament, and Wenger spoke about him having the potential to one day play centre mid. Obviously, when he first came into the Arsenal team, he played at fullback quite a lot and got exposed because he's not the fastest player. Then ends up playing as a centre back more lately. But yeah, he didn't look out of place at all in centre mid.
Okay. Last time Fulham went to Old Trafford, not sure what year this was. Oh, Duncan, you'll know.
Yeah, 2014.
Okay.
And it was possibly one of the most iconic David Moyes era Manchester United games.
Was it the crosses game?
Yeah, the 81 crosses that United put in, which is a Premier League record. And
the result was 2-2. And under Mourinho, they still have a terrible record, United, against promoted sides. Lost to all three of them last season.
Yeah, that was the first time that had happened. There's something. Manchester United Fulham is quite an iconic fixture, strangely. I mean, Fulham's first ever game in the Premier League way back, under Jean Tigana was away at United. Ruud van Nistelrooy's debut, he scored twice. Louis Sahar scored twice for Fulham. So I think it's got the potential to be quite a memorable match. And given what happened to Moyes shortly after that match, it was the beginning of the end, really. So, I mean, we say this every week, don't we? But it could be the beginning of the end for Mo.
Yeah. Perhaps the biggest game of the weekend will come on Saturday evening as Chelsea host Man City. Chelsea coming off two defeats in their last three. Duncan, you'd warned of this. You'd warned of the existence of a West London bubble.
Yes.
Did they listen?
Didn't. Back a few weeks ago when Chelsea was sort of keeping pace with Liverpool and City, their underlying numbers showed that it probably wasn't going to last. They were, you know, letting the opposition have a lot more good quality chances. And I think we've seen that in their two recent defeats, in the sense that Spurs created a lot of good chances and comfortably beat them. Wolves didn't really create a lot of chances, but they certainly, you know, were comfortable in the second half. And I think we're probably at a point now, I mean, David should have an opinion on this, I guess, but where we're should probably start questioning how Kepa is doing at Chelsea, because Wolves scored with their only two shots on target on Wednesday. And the reason that Chelsea were getting away with all these big chances wasn't that Kepa was making loads of saves. It was actually that the opposition were just missing them. So he actually hasn't been that impressive, but he's sort of gone under the radar a bit, I think.
Yeah, I think apart from the first game against Huddersfield, where he looked a little shaky and he came for a couple of crosses, and his physical presence isn't very authoritative. But I think it was a little harsh. Somebody said it was a Kepa howler, the first goal last night. And sometimes when a ball goes in close to a goalkeeper, it's, you know, questions are asked. But those areas sort of down low to your left, sort of like a, it's like a triangle between your hip, your hand, and your foot. It's, unless you just go with your feet, as soon as you start going with your hands, you're dead, you're never going to get down there. So it looks like it just literally goes straight through you.
If I'm bearing down on you, David, which triangle should I aim at? Would it be the one down to your left?
Yeah, or the one that David De Gea quite frequently gets beat at, is, which is sort of under his arms here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's a lot easier to move your arm out that way than it's less natural to come inside. So it's sort of just side of the hips.
All right.
But it's... yeah, Kepa, it's just strange that he's been lumbered with his $70 million price tag when he's nowhere near worth that at all, and everyone knows that. But the expectation's still going to be there.
How annoying is it as a goalkeeper when someone scores past you and puts the ball between your legs? Is it comparable in any way to a nutmeg for an outfield player, or do you just sort of...
No, not at all, because that's what, again, that's another, it's another weak spot. So someone like Sergio Aguero, he trains to put the ball there. And it's difficult now, because in situations where, when, especially when balls are wide, like it was for the first goal, Wolves' first goal last night, you've got to go with your feet more now. So people in a higher stance, their hands should be higher, and their legs are wider apart. Whereas traditionally, with British goalkeeping, you get told you must always be shoulder width apart. But it's what happens is when somebody shoots, you jump outwards and then back in again to go out again. Whereas now it's more continental methods, where you start with a wider stance. So if the ball does go low, you just go with your feet. And I think if Kepa had had a wider stance and a more upright stance, he'd have just stuck the leg out.
That's
and saved
why
it.
You need Scott McTominay crouching behind you at all times.
That's true.
Great shout. Sarri sounds really worried. I'm really worried, there you go, that we didn't react to their first goal. What is it? Have Chelsea lost their intensity?
Possibly. I mean, like Duncan said, I mean, the signs have perhaps been there despite their encouraging form. I mean, I think a big factor in the two most recent defeats has been Jorginho. Obviously, he was shut down very effectively by Dele Alli when they lost to Spurs at Wembley. And then last night, he was kept on the bench. And, you know, Sarri, as we know, is a manager who likes to keep faith with his starting 11. He made a few changes last night. Fabregas came in. Andreas Christensen came in. Ruben Loftus-Cheek came in and scored again. But they're obviously not quite the same team without Jorginho. And the thing that Sarri pinpointed was the loss of control. You know, Chelsea went ahead first half, seemed to be on top of the game, were making chances. And as soon as Wolves equalised, the whole complexion of the game changed. And that's when you need your little man in midfield to put his foot on the board and sort of slow things down.
Which Fabregas, I guess, was meant to be doing.
Which I guess Fabregas was meant to be doing, but he's clearly not.
A few passes than Jorginho would have done traditionally. But I think also they're just not scoring enough goals. You know, Hazard hasn't scored for ages. Morata and Giroud aren't particularly reliable. And when you know as a team that goals are not just going to flow from all sources, look how much more confident Arsenal look now that they know that Lacazette, Aubameyang and various others are going to score.
What's that stat, Duncan, about Hazard only scoring when Morata doesn't start?
Yeah, this season Hazard's goals have come when he's been on the pitch with Giroud, but then Giroud scored one goal, so you know, can you play another player just to kind of, you know, help someone else?
The Emil Heskey paradigm. Sorry, Tom.
France won the World Cup with Olivier Giroud.
Yeah,
I've said this before, but I think Giroud is the absolute perfect foil for Hazard. I can't think of a single centre-forward in world football who is a better partner for a player like Hazard, who is always looking for little one-twos, who needs someone to play off. And if one of the consequences of them playing together is that Giroud only scores 6 goals this season, but that Hazard scores 30, you take that over Morata, God love him, just running down endless blind alleyways.
Fair enough. Wolves, a return to form for them, or something that had been coming?
Well, they seem to play quite well when they play bigger teams. I don't know whether it's the kind of the more technical approach that suits their players rather than the blood and thunder of the lower teams. But, I mean, the standout was Morgan Gibbs-White, who made his first start in the Premier League, first of that World Cup winning team to start a Premier League game, and got an assist on his full debut. So, you know, he looks to be... You'd think he'd now get a good run in the team, fitness permitting, and looks like he deserves it.
They needed that, though. Nuno needed that. Six games without a win, and there's no danger of them ever going down, I don't think. But it's they just didn't have that cutting edge. You'd think that they'd bring somebody in January. I mean, I quite like Jimenez. You know, he's does great work around the box, great hold up play, link up play, but his finishing's lacking this year.
All right. Well, Chelsea dropped to 10 points off the top now. And next up it is, as we mentioned, Man City, who are rumbling along on top like something out of... Have you seen those trailers for Mortal Engines? Those kind of vast cities on wheels that kind of rumble across the landscape, destroying everything in their path. Yeah, I mean, that's the metaphor.
I mean, that sounds about right.
Yeah. David, you went to see City at Watford on Tuesday. Yep. It was actually quite close at the end, wasn't it?
It was a lot closer than it should have been. But, I mean, it's just from that... From the first minute of every game, teams on the back foot against City. City have they work a chance in the first, the first sort of moments of the game, and then from that on, so it's almost like a puncher getting punched in the first second, and then they're sort of trying to cover up for the rest of the fight. And it's to be fair to Watford, I mean,
they came close at the end.
I like Watford as a side. Last season, I thought towards the end of last season, I liked them, and they thought they were playing well. And this season they're the same. They're a different one to work out because I still think they should be doing even better than what they are. I know Troy Deeney's done well for Watford over the years, but they're probably a better striker away from challenging that top six.
Well, their goal here came from Doucouré,
yeah,
and sparked a little bit of panic in among Man City's. Ranks, but City do emerge with the 3 points. 21 games without defeat for Pep, a goal difference of plus 38. Duncan, that must be a record.
It's the best since Sunderland in 1892-93, back in David's time.
Glory days.
That's a long time.
That is quite a long time ago, yeah.
Wow.
City won 49 of their last 57 Premier League games. Mm-hmm. Just to...
Right, they've only been behind, as I'm sure you told us before, for 12 minutes all season.
But what a 12
minutes.
And that
was against Wolves, actually. Yeah, what a 12 minutes. All right, well, what's going to happen when they face... what was it? Is it at Chelsea, this, is it?
Mm.
Yeah. They've taken on Chelsea once before in the Community Shield, excitingly, when it finished 2-0 to City... A brace for Sergio Aguero, who was one of the many changes that Pep made for this game, both Sterling and Aguero out of the picture. There's some suggestion that Aguero's not going to be fit for this weekend either, or is he meant to be back? We'll see.
It looks like he's going to be out, I think, by the sounds of things, which means another run out for Gabriel Jesus, who's a funny one, because you remember how excited we all were when he first came to City, and they, the next big thing to come out of Brazilian football.
Absolutely.
He was their first choice number 9 at the World Cup, and he just hasn't really kicked on at all. And you see little flashes, and there was a moment in the first half against Watford where he made a bit of space for himself over by the left-hand, by the byline on the left-hand side and set someone up. But he doesn't really feel like he's kind of kicked on in a way that a lot of the players that Guardiola's worked with
have. Picked up a couple of injuries as well. Yeah. That set him off for a little while as well. That's held him back. But did you see Edison's no-look pass?
I'm not sure that I did.
Yeah.
To be fair.
Yeah. Yeah, it's ridiculous. Just him and Alisson are just taking goalkeeping to another level.
Right.
Another one for Edison, I think, quite late on, where someone played a back pass to him and overhit it a bit. One of those that I imagine goalkeepers don't appreciate very much, that arrives around hip height.
Mm.
He took a touch to set it, took another touch, and then just volleyed it back down the pitch.
Magnificent.
I mean, he's so good. Well,
who's Edison. Better, David? Is it Alisson or Edison? I've got a couple of tweets here. I don't like cricket. Asked if Alisson is the best goalkeeper of all time or the second best goalkeeper of all time. Scared Bobby British. Alisson's footwork, absolutely phenomenal, or am I just blinded by bias for thinking that he's magnificent? Who do you prefer?
Alisson's better from the waist up, Edison's better from the waist down.
In every sense, probably.
Well, I mean, just a shaving sauce. You know what I mean?
Right, okay, so...
Edison's range of passing, as good as Alisson's is, which is phenomenal,
right.
Edison's is just ridiculous. Watching him in training with the rest of the City squad, as good as technically as they are, he looks, there's no difference whatsoever.
He could play outfield in that team.
I mean, I've made the point before that he's got a pass completion rate that in the late 90s would have made him the best midfielder in the
Yeah, but look at his range of passing, though. It's not just like Lloris, where he's just passing it short a lot. His range of passing is ridiculous. And the best thing about him, the same with Alisson, is that how calm they are. What even just in training sessions, he trains, Edison trains sort of, it's intense, his work rate. But most of the time, it's almost like he's flatlining, especially when he's got the ball at his feet in the short, in sort of like pressurised, small-sided games. He's just not worried at all, okay. Not under pressure at all.
But Alisson from the waist up?
Yeah, just because I think he's a better goalkeeper, a better shot stopper.
Okay.
But traditional goalkeeping. But last night, just talking about distribution, Kasper Schmeichel last night, the same way that Guardiola is influencing coaches to and giving them the bravery to play the way that he is, likes of Edison and Alisson, it's raising the bar for distribution and giving goalkeepers the confidence to play more difficult balls. So last night, I was getting upset with Chilwell myself because Schmeichel was, whether it was a half volley off the deck, he was hitting it perfectly to him and he was letting it go off each toe, he was chesting it away, and I was close enough to throw my pen at him, and I was close a few times just to pinging at him, like, you know.
David was quite animated.
Yeah.
He had to be restrained on a couple of occasions.
It was delightful, absolutely delightful.
Incredible.
I know this isn't a home for my fetishes, but thanks for letting me hear that.
No, not at all. So when Edison and his teammates arrive at Stamford Bridge on Saturday evening, Tom, what's your prediction?
I can't see anything but a City win. I just think the level they're playing at, I mean, they're even better than they were last season. And I think we're a bit blinded to that because you kind of got used to them being incredible last season. But, watching them against the first half against Watford, and they just hit that rhythm, like, from kickoff. There's no sort of feeling their way into the game. As soon as they've got the ball, they're in control. And I don't see Chelsea in their current form hurting them.
What about Maurizio Sarri springing some kind of hideous surprise tactically?
But he's not really a surpriser, is he, Sarri? No, it's basically plan A, and if plan A doesn't work, we'll just make it a bit better and try again. I mean, obviously, they'll be full strength again. Jorginho will come back into the team.
Right, and am I being tactically naive when I ask, there's no way that Pep will bother putting somebody on Jorginho the way that teams who've been successful against Chelsea have been doing?
Probably not. Again, that's just not really a Guardiola sort of thing. He'll count on his players crowding Jorginho because that's generally what they do when they're out of possession. And I think he'll probably have enough faith in City's pressing game to trust them to do that without having to pinpoint someone to follow Jorginho all over the pitch.
The thing is, I said it here last year that you're on a high nothing against City anyway, so why not just go after them and maybe not do exactly what they do, but go sort of like Bielsa style 11v11, man for man all over the pitch and try and get some. That way, the only team that's done it, that did it to them, was Liverpool last season.
Look what happened then. With great results. Yeah. Liverpool, of course, were Chelsea to take points off Man City Saturday, could find themselves top of the table. They're only 2 points behind, and they're going to be at Bournemouth, who did get a much-needed win midweek against Huddersfield. Callum Wilson and Ryan Fraser combining delightfully. Stein saying, is there a better bromance in the Premier League right now than Ryan Fraser and Callum Wilson? Probably not, Stein. Probably not.
Yeah, I mean, Wilson's obviously been linked with Chelsea. And
has he?
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that.
Well, he has. And with the January window roaring towards us, like winter itself, it could happen. It'd be quite it would make sense, but it'd be sad for Bournemouth. One thing about that game on Tuesday was it was the first Premier League game to have less than 10,000 people at it since 2000.
Really?
Yeah.
The Bournemouth game?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the 90s, there were plenty of low-attended games, the lowest being Wimbledon-Everton back in 1993, which had just over 3,000. But, yeah, I'm not denigrating the Bournemouth fans. But,
no, I mean, equally, Spurs had
Spurs are closing in on that record, aren't they?
Yeah. Only 33,000 at Wembley, which obviously is a lot more than 10,000, but
it probably says more about Huddersfield than Bournemouth, really.
Right, and Saints in Spurs' case. We'll talk about that match a little bit later on. Tom, though, as an outspoken advocate of Giroud as Hazard's partner, how would you feel about Callum Wilson joining Maurizio Sarri's team?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Wilson would be as good a foil for Hazard as Giroud, but I mean, clearly he's in form and Chelsea need a striker who scores goals, and you'd hope that if that does go through, it works out for him, because, you know, we all know that the injury problems that he's come through. He's now an England international. He's been in brilliant form for Bournemouth this season. You know, got a great relationship with the players around him, whether it's Ryan Fraser, David Brooks, Josh King. So, I mean, yeah, if that does go ahead, hopefully he, you know, makes a success of it.
All right. I kind of hope he stays at Bournemouth. Bournemouth, anyway, did get the win against Huddersfield. I mentioned him scoring, him setting up Ryan Fraser as well. They now host Liverpool, who had a bit of a scare away at Turf Moor. They put a kind of B team out. Would that be fair, David? Lots of players rested. Salah on the bench, Firmino on the bench. And lo and behold, the Clarets took the lead. Well, first of all, they almost took the lead with that wonderful Barnes, that Ashley Barnes volley. But then after your pal, Alisson, forgot to control the ball, it was Cork, Jack Cork.
Yeah, he just stabbed it in the net, yeah.
Great example of Alisson, by the way. You're saying that Alisson's hands, you like, when he launched the counter-attack, which led to Shaqiri's goal.
Well, this is it. I mean, they criticised Loris Karius last year because sometimes he was too hasty trying to get counter-attacks away, and that led to errors by him. But with Alisson, it was the first thing, I got a few texts straight away as soon as they scored it, and just a few texts just saying, Alisson, watch it. And then it's the 2-1 up in the end of a game, and people are talking about Jordan Pickford, you know, maybe he's criticising him for trying to catch the ball, and if they want to, you know, I don't think he was trying to launch an attack at the weekend, but some people say...
Well, let's talk about Jordan Pickford then, because... You were a lone voice in support of him after the Derby defeat. So talk us through why you think it wasn't that big an error.
Well, it's simply because it was a difficult situation. That ball, that's a high dropping ball, like an up and under, it's the most difficult ball to judge in for a goalkeeper. And regardless of what anybody else, you know, their perspective of the goal and what their opinion is, you could see that, you know, in most situations, people can get a good idea what's happening. In that situation, Jordan Pickford is the only one who's got that perspective of the ball, and that's the one just dropping straight on top of him. Now, in that situation, more often than not, that ball arrives at you quicker than what you anticipate. And if you can judge those balls, which people don't train, and this is the thing, you don't really train for those high balls up and unders at that height. It's difficult to judge. So when the ball's coming down on top of the bar, it looks as if from the side angle that it's going to be it's dropping just on the back half of the post, the bar, so it'll go out. But he doesn't know that. It's impossible for him to judge. And from what he said, he's put two hands there as insurance. And if it hits his hands, he's relying on assuming that it's just going to be enough to take it out. But I mean, you've got to say that. His game management, that time of the game, you know, there's a point resting on it. It would have been a good result for them. He's got to err on the side of safety. But I don't think it was an error in the same way that David De Gea's was an error last night.
But, and at the time, you made the point that, for example, people spoke out about Mourinho giving Marcus Rashford grief for the miss that he made.
There was no criticism of obviously it was a glaring miss for him not even hit the target from that distance. And it's a far easier situation than what Jordan Pickford faced. Yet there was no criticism of Pickford, and everyone's stood up, quite rightly so, saying that Mourinho shouldn't be sort of shown his displeasure at his at a young player. Well, why not do that for Jordan Pickford?
Because he's a goalie.
Exactly.
Thanks for that, David. There's more, though. We're not done with Burnley-Liverpool yet, are we?
No, Liverpool are in this weird situation where they've equaled the record for fewest number of goals conceded after 15 games, which is good. They've got the seventh best start to any top-flight season in the history of English football, and yet it still feels like they're barely hanging on to Manchester City. So in any other league, in any other season, they would be, you know, comfortably clear. If this was 1958, which in some ways it is, they would be 13 points clear at the top.
That's amazing, isn't it? Well, you never know, because if my suspicions prove to be correct and Chelsea do something to Man City and Liverpool do win this game at Bournemouth, then hello, top spot.
Well, also Liverpool play first, so if they win, they will go top. They can put the pressure on. Just to come off the back of what Duncan was saying, this is Liverpool's best ever start to a top flight season in their 126-year history. This is the 18-time champions of England, and they've never made such a good start to a season, and yet they're still 2 points off the top, and we're all still a little bit underwhelmed by them, which is crackers, really, when you look at the results.
What they're on course for is at 98 points or something at the moment.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
I mean, there's Liverpool fans who'll say that they're deliberately playing a little bit slowly to sort of rest the players so they can go hard in the spring, or it could just be that it's not working out for them, but you can't say it's not working out for them because they
clearly is.
Yeah,
absolutely. So. Well, Liverpool do have a big game coming up the following midweek when they'll be hosting Napoli, of course. And Joe Gomez, worryingly, looking like he's probably not going to be part of that particular fixture.
Yeah, we was hurt in a challenge by Ben Mee, and Jurgen Klopp was unhappy with a lot of Burnley's challenges. I think he felt that they were getting away with a few too many slide challenges. And as any schoolboy footballer who's ever played football in the rain will know, it's very hard to resist the temptation to launch yourself into a big slidey when the grass is wet. But Jurgen Klopp felt that Burnley got a bit carried away.
Ben Mee, shake me.
Well, yes.
Right, anyway. So, well, that's exciting. Then Bournemouth taking on Liverpool. I have no idea. When is that game taking place? Saturday afternoon?
Saturday lunchtime, I think. Yeah.
Saturday lunchtime, early. Well, what a great start to the round of matches. Hey, speaking of starts, let's stop for a second or two, and then we'll come back with more things, including, hello, Ralph Hasenhüttl, after this.
Ah, Christmas. The time of generosity, great food, terrible television, even worse jumpers, and a packed Premier League fixture list. And nobody does generosity at Christmas like Paddy Power. We're giving money back as a free bet on at least one game in every round of fixtures. The only people paying out as much this Christmas will be Man United, when they inevitably terminate their manager's contract. Ah, you'd be a turkey to bet anywhere else. Paddy Power, enough of the nonsense. Applies to first bet on all losing goal scorer, correct score and what odds Paddy bets. Max refund £10. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Sunderland supporters, rubberneckers, etc. We've got an interview in our Totally Football League show with Ben Turner and Leo Perlman, two of the guys from Fall 73, who've made the new Sunderland documentary that's going to be on Netflix. This is very exciting. We've got a quick taster for you as well.
Certainly when we started the filming and when we approached the club and Netflix to talk about this series, it wasn't with the intention of following the club that we love getting relegated for the second time in a row. It was very much with the idea that this great club would bounce straight back up to the Premiership heroically and we'd have lots to celebrate. In terms of filmmaker's perspective, the drama that came with a change of manager, or two changes of managers even, the takeover of the club and the relegation certainly gave us more than we could have ever hoped for. I say hoped in inverted commas, hoped for the series. But no, it wasn't something that we expected at the start, that's for sure.
Well, you can hear the full interview on the latest TFLS with Caroline Barker. About 32 minutes in, Tom, if you want to skip the other bits about AFC Wimbledon, Ipswich and Rotherham. The show, Sunderland Till I Die, starts, David, on Netflix on 14th of December. You're ringing that in red in your diary.
Yeah.
Are you in it, by the way?
Well, do you know what? I was supposed to be. I was in the first. I did a couple of interviews at the start. Uh-huh. And I just couldn't get back up to Sunderland to film the rest of it. So I'm probably on the cutting room floor, I think.
Fair loss.
Yeah.
Oh, well. It's a big week for Spurs. They're at Leicester this weekend. They're at the Camp Nou on Tuesday, where they need to win to stand any chance of qualifying for the knockout rounds of the Champions League. And on Wednesday, they were at Wembley welcoming Saints new manager Ralph Hasenhüttl by spanking his Saints 3-1. He was there watching in the stands. Good thing he was, because very few other people were, as we mentioned. Spurs, comfortable winners there. They go third in the table, ahead of Chelsea. But I think perhaps the bigger question here is what to make of the Hasenhüttl appointment. On one hand, he's one of the brighter stars of this incredible generation of young German managers. But on the other, he's a foreign fella who's never had any experience of British football and the Premier League.
And his first match, he's got Neil Warnock. That's an introduction.
Away at Cardiff. Right.
Ultimate culture shock.
Let's speak to the always cultured Raphael Honigstein, a man who knows all about Herr Hasenhüttl. Ralph Hasenhüttl has gone to Saints, you know. Should Saints fans be happy about this?
Yeah, I think they should be happy about it, because it seems to me that he is the kind of guy that fits the Southampton blueprint, or at least a blueprint that was very much in action when they had the likes of Maurizio Pochettino there, a guy who might not have sort of the biggest name in English football just yet, but his working methods, his playing style, his track record, I think all suggest that he is exactly the kind of guy that you'd want, A, in a relegation battle, and B, with a view of progressing with a team that cannot rely on big player sales, yes, but not buys. He's not going to be a guy who's looking for excuses. He's not going to be a guy who's talking down his own team. He's going to do absolutely everything to make sure that what he has, and I think it's fairly considerable, there shouldn't be one of the worst teams in the league, considering their squad, will be utilized. And I think he is a real coach in that sense. And I think that's exactly what Southampton need at this point, somebody who can take a team, take players who are a little bit low on confidence and give them that sense of purpose back and a very strong idea of how they should play. And I think that is sort of half the battle won already.
Thanks to Ingolstadt and of course, Leipzig, is it fair to say he's one of the biggest, kind of, or the brightest stars of this crop of young German managers?
It would be fair to say that in 1938, when Germany and Austria were one of the same country. But now, James, it's fair to say he's one of the best German-speaking managers coming through.
Oh, he's Austrian.
He's Austrian, yes.
Right, okay. Nicely handled, Raf.
Yes.
But no, I was going to say, but he's not. He has managed abroad then in Germany, but he's not managed in the UK or in the Premier League. Do you harbour any doubts about how well he's going to be able to adapt or the team will adapt to him?
I don't really. I don't think that the Premier League is no longer sort of a league where you need very specialist knowledge to succeed. I think it's become so international and teams that you're up against play such a varied style, a lot of them fairly continental, really, which is not surprising if you look at the personnel involved at all levels, that the adaptation, I think certainly in the short term, is not going to be too big. When it then comes to sort of planning a season and planning a squad and getting to grips with the travel arrangements and with the amount of games, I think these are sort of things that he will have to learn. But I think in the short run, just trying to improve a side that is a little bit lost at the moment, I don't see why his methods, which have shown to be working in a broad sense with Pochettino at Southampton, with Pochettino at Spurs, with Klopp at Liverpool, with David Wagner at Huddersfield, I don't see why they should not be just as successful at Southampton.
Yep, Ralf Hasenhüttl is not predicted by you, Duncan, of course, famously last week.
Well, yeah, I was...
wrong.
Is one word for it, yeah.
Okay. Now, it just so happened that on Tuesday, I was sat in a studio with two people who were discussing his arrival. One was Alan Shearer and the other one was Tim Sherwood. I wonder if you can guess what they thought about the decision to hire him as opposed to, say, a British manager, David.
Well, I did the phrase, I don't know much about him, but...
No. Tim, for example, was saying, you know, he's come in, he knows nothing about the league. I had the same situation at Aston Villa, where, of course, Remy Gard took over. And I think they were 13th under Sherwood and then they ended up going down. So I don't know. There is always that question about somebody coming in who doesn't know the Premier League. In some ways, it's a valid point.
There is, but the style that's especially all like the German and Austrian coaches that they come to the country and playing that this type of football is that it's literally a traditional English style, but with brains.
Mm.
So they're taking the brawn and adding some brains to it, and then the pressing game is much more intelligent rather than just. Teams in the 80s and 90s pressed opposition, but it was kind of like, you know, you go and press the first, you know, the nearest man go and press the ball, then everyone else just following behind them. Where this one's a little bit more method behind it.
But. All right. Pochettino, of course, arrived at Southampton in an almost identical time of year. What was it, January when he took over from Thinks Very Hard?
Nigel Adkins.
Nice man, yeah, Nigel Adkins.
And obviously that led to a massive protest by Southampton fans who were not happy with this foreign manager coming in. It turned out he was quite good. Southampton managers tend to start quite badly. The last manager to win his first Premier League game as Southampton boss was Paul Sturrock.
Oh.
Now, I don't know if they have fried egg baps in Austria, but we could find out.
I'd like to find out. It is a tricky start that awaits Ralf Hasenhüttl after the trip to Cardiff, who've won, I think, the last three games at home. They have Arsenal, then away at Huddersfield, and then West Ham, and then Man City. What do you think? Are they going to kick things off with a good result at Cardiff?
I don't know. I mean, what Cardiff have got, they've got a bit of metal, you know. Rather than all the teams around them, if they weren't going to win games, they were certainly going to draw the way at the double figures. So I think that they're behind confidence as well. I fancy them. I actually fancy Cardiff at home.
I think the difficulty when you appoint a manager like Ralph Hasenhüttl is that it will take time for his methods to get across. And when you're in a relegation dogfight, time is one thing that you don't necessarily have, which is why, generally speaking, in recent seasons, when Premier League clubs have changed manager in the situation, they've gone for the sort of classic British firefighter who will make your team hard to break down and tighten things up at the back, blah, blah, blah. So perhaps the fact that they've got these tricky fixtures isn't necessarily the worst thing in the world, because Southampton fans won't necessarily expect to get anything from those games. And during that time, the new manager can be working on team shape and the pressing and everything. So perhaps by the time we get to the turn of the year, they'll be more advanced down the evolutionary path that I'm sure Hasenhüttl has in mind for them.
Do you know what Hasenhüttl means?
Someone said this the other day.
Rabbit Hutch.
Rabbit Hutch.
Yeah. So it's Ralph Rabbit Hutch.
Nice.
Yeah, well, at least we know he's going to go with the carrot, not the stick method.
Hey!
Let's hope he's not hair today, gone tomorrow. Sorry.
People of the Totally Football Show, you know what you could be listening to right here? You could be listening to you, your company, your product, out here in front of hundreds and thousands of listeners who are mostly men aged between the ages of 25 and 44. And it's not just this show either. We've got a whole network of podcasts. There's Galazzo for your considered cosmopolitan listener. There's the Totally Football League show for your loyal, hardy listener. There's the Totally Scottish Football show for your listener who likes those big square sausages. And we've got more shows on the way too. To discuss advertising across the Totally Football Show network, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. We reach well over a million pairs of ears each week. And now you can too. Email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.
Do you know what I'd like to talk about now? Brighton. We never get enough chance to talk about Brighton. This is the perfect opportunity because they're fresh from the M23 Derby.
Yeah, never trust the Derby named after a road, in my opinion.
How many other ones? Are there other Derbys?
There's the M40 Derby, which is Wickham and Oxford.
Okay.
And I think there's probably a few in the northwest.
There's one in Canada. It's something like the Highway 405 Derby.
And I like that.
Toronto
that
cool, against Montreal Impact. It's quite a long highway, though. Like, it's a lot along the. It's a lot longer than the M23.
If there's more than two numbers, it sounds good. So maybe you want like the B. B4382.
Sounds exotic.
But anyway, So they had this game, Eagles v Seagulls, and that, and the centuries of bitterness between these two communities resulted in a 3-1 win. A 3-1 win. It was 3-1, wasn't it?
3-1, yeah.
With just 10 men. What a fantastic performance from Brighton.
Yeah, Shane Duffy was sent off for Brighton. All four of Brighton's red cards in the Premier League have been straight reds, which I admire. It's a commitment that you don't often get in the modern game. And those three goals, it's 6% of the goals Brighton have ever scored in the Premier League.
Sorry?
So 6% of the goals Brighton have ever scored in the Premier League were those three in the first half against their arch rivals, which is pleasing for Brighton fans, I imagine.
That's an extraordinary high proportion.
Yeah, they don't score many goals, Brighton.
So. I'm getting that, yeah. That's amazing, though.
And also, the first time in Premier League history that two substitutes have scored in the first half.
Ah, OK. So, who were they?
Balogun and...
Florin Andone.
OK, so one came on as part of the tactical rejig after Shane Duffy got sent off. The other came on for Glenn Murray, who did his shoulder in part of the incident which led to the Duffy head rub thing. And that's a real worry. It's nice that he scored. Who was it came on for him?
Florin Andone.
Thank you very much.
Who my laptop autocorrect keeps trying to rename Andwon. If you type Andone into your phone or tablet device...
It's a ducking disgrace.
It puts a space in there where space is needed.
Right, but anyway, Andone... Because it looks like he might have to be, you know, carrying the goal-scoring burden for a bit, not such as it is at Brighton, because Glenn Murray's done his shoulder, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, Brighton have been very dependent on Glenn Murray in recent seasons, and despite his advancing years, he's proved a very reliable getter of goals in the Premier League. And, you know, there has been that worry that when he's not firing or when he's not fit, there's no one there. But Andoni, two goals in two. He got the winner at Huddersfield at the weekend and then scored a really good goal at Palace, sort of picks the ball up on the left, drives past James Tomkins, cuts inside and scores. So obviously Murray being out will be a worry for Brighton, particularly if he's out for any length of time. Mm. But maybe Andoni can come in and do the job.
He went into second gear and drove past Tomkins.
Oh, right, yeah.
He's in quicksand.
Poor old James Tomkins. Bad news all round for Palace, who've also been infested with mice at their training ground, I hear. Is that actually quite a common thing, David?
Not that I've, not that I know of. I did get food poisoning once at Aberdeen.
Right.
Yeah, it's not a great thing having to take a sample of your own...
Runs.
Yeah, nice. Exactly. It's horrible, yeah.
Dribbles and runs.
Yeah. We had a game called off because all night it was coming at both ends, like projectile.
No, okay, all right, I'm moving on at this point. So, but Palace, that's just part of the problem. Poor old Uncle Roy was left sat there in the rain at the Amex at the end. He said there were no positives to take from the game.
Well, I got a penalty.
Well, tell him that. Yeah.
Well, they're the only team not to make any changes, Palace. So that's also worrying because other teams who made changes and then didn't perform or had to then bring on their usual first choice players could say, well, you know, we shook it up and the team, the reserves weren't really ready, whereas Palace stuck to what should be the winning formula.
And especially worrying because it was against 10 men, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, if you're playing against 10 men for over an hour, you would expect, well, first and foremost, you'd expect to be the team who take control of the game, you have all the possession, but you know, by half time they're 3-0 down and the game's already beyond them. That's a bit of a worry.
Heading into this weekend's games then, it's an interesting scenario at the bottom. Things beginning to... We talked about things getting delineated up top, Tom, earlier, and it's beginning to happen. There's that some of that coalescing down there as well, because you've got the bottom three all on 9 points, Saints, Burnley and Fulham, and then basically Huddersfield, Cardiff... Palace and Newcastle are all within 4 points of them, but then you've got a big 5-point gap to West Ham, Duncan.
Yeah, and then West Ham are playing Palace this weekend, so if they win that, and they've obviously got a reasonable good run of games over Christmas, then you'd think that the bottom seven could become detached, and that could be the relegation battle as we head into the second half of the season.
I see. Well, other games this weekend include Brighton. We'll be seeing if they can continue their... They had a win away from home, didn't they, the other day? They're going to be trying to do that away at Burnley, which is usually a good spot for a victory on the road. Newcastle will be hosting Wolves amid talk of four bids for Mike Ashley's club. Peter Kenyon is behind one. Apparently he's found the funding necessary. There's rival bids, though, it is believed, from the US, Middle East and Turkey. We have been here before, but the word is that they think a deal could be done within weeks. Let's see. And on Monday night, the Premier League round concludes with Everton taking on Watford, which will be an emotional affair for Marco Silva and Richarlison. Okay. Oh, by the way, on the subject of keepers, yeah. David, is Ben Foster the signing of the summer? You saw him in action against Man City, who would have been five or six up had it not been for the actions of Ben.
Yeah, he was up as he needed another pair of hands, but he's... I think there's a few people saying that he had a poor season last year, and I thought every time I saw him, I thought he did really well, West Brom. He's certainly got a bit of a resurgence, but he's a solid goalkeeper, and I think he's not firefighting like he was with West Brom. You know, he's not just keeping the score down, he's making a difference. And although they didn't get the result of the night, he made sure that they were well within the game towards the end, and... Yeah, it gave him a chance of getting a point anyway.
Looking good, Ben Foster. Yeah. Looking good. All right, well, there's loads of other football around the world. We'll be touching on some of that, the key stories, including Tom's trip to Monte Carlo after this.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsors of Melchester Rovers. Find out more at RoyTheRoversOfficial.com.
Listener, in other news, Scotland, Kilmarnock are top. David, this is exciting, isn't it? How much of a shock is it?
Yeah, it is a little bit of a shock, but Steve Clark's doing wonders up there.
Right. You know, well done, Inyo says, what do you think of the job Steve Clark is doing at Kilmarnock? Well, wonders. Do you think Premier League clubs will be keeping an eye on his progress?
Possibly, but I think he's got to be in the frame for the next Scotland manager, whenever that is. There's not many too many candidates for that. But certainly if anything happens to Brendan Rodgers or Steven Gerrard, then those jobs will probably, he'll probably be up for those. But
yeah,
I mean, even some of the players, I played with a lad, Alan Power, who went from Lincoln to Kilmarnock and playing centre midfield for him now, and he's performed brilliantly for them. And he's still getting a tune out of Chris Boyd up front, who's still scoring goals. So, yeah, all credit him.
They had a 2-0 win at home to Livingston. They've only lost one game in 11. They haven't conceded in their last four. And as I say, they are now top of the table in this very surprising SPL season.
Yeah, and top mainly because Aberdeen beat Rangers at Ibrox with only 10 men.
Remarkable.
Which is a shame.
Well, there are loads more killy chat, Duncan, in this week's Totally Scottish Football Show with Andrew Slaven and the gang. The Chequered Trade Trophy. Sol Campbell really was in the dugout this midweek as Maxwell took on Newcastle's under-21s. How did it go?
He didn't lose.
But he didn't win either. He's not in the competition any longer.
They drew the game.
They drew the game, but then there was a shootout, and for the first time in their history, Macclesfield lost in a penalty shootout. By Corumba, 5-3. Elsewhere in that tournament, it was the first Potteries derby in 16 years. Port Vale taking on Stoke's under-21s. People got a little bit emotional about this one. There were 11 arrests, toilet systems were broken off the walls, seats got hurled and windows broken. Staffordshire Police described the match as their biggest footballing operation for 10 years. Stoke's under-21s got knocked out 4-0 by Port Vale.
Yeah, a strong side of Port Vale.
Presumably Port Vale will be using Chequered Trade to find a good plumber to replace the toilet systems.
How funny. Tom, you're off to France this weekend.
Yes, well, technically Monaco.
Oh, yeah.
But yes, via France.
You'll be going through France, yeah. It's a nice trip, though, isn't it? You arrive in Nice, chopper across to Monte Carlo.
Yeah, chopper
or just
chartered.
Sail the yacht round.
Yeah. I'm umming and ahhing between the chopper and the yacht at the moment.
Okay, and you're there because?
Because Monaco face Nice on Friday evening, the big Thierry Henry, Patrick Vieira derby.
Right, okay. Now, Monaco come into this having freshly emerged from the relegation zone in Ligue 1.
Almost.
Oh.
They're currently in the relegation playoff place.
Okay.
So they are third bottom, but they are behind Caen on goal difference alone.
Right.
They've won two of their last three, so early days, but signs that they might have turned a corner at long last. Nice have been on a good run of form. I think they're 8 games unbeaten, but they've drawn the last two 0-0, so their form has tailed off a bit. And yeah, Monaco seem to be getting things together somewhat belatedly. So yeah, interesting to see who comes out on top out of the former Arsenal and France teammates.
Patrick Vieira was so highly touted when he arrived at Nice. How popular is he there at the moment, though?
Well, he's pretty popular.
Mario Balotelli, though.
As every manager who's worked with Balotelli, there have been issues. Balotelli's entire summer was spent in the midst of this transfer saga with Marseille. It looked like it was going to happen. It was on, it was off, it was on, it was off. Finally, he stayed at Nice. So now 3 seasons that he'll have been at Nice by the end of this season. And he reported back from pre-season, not in shape. Vieira basically took him to task over that. They worked on his fitness. And he's now looking fitter, but he's still playing really poorly. He was substituted early in the game at Guingamp at the weekend and wasn't best pleased about it. It's just not going for him. And I think that's one of the issues that Vieira's got, is that he's tightened them up defensively. They're sort of playing with a back three, and they're pretty solid in midfield, and they're relying on Balotelli and Alain Saint-Maximin, very exciting young winger who sort of plays just off Balotelli in a free role. But neither of those two are in great form at the moment. I think that's one of the big reasons why the goals have dried up.
I see. In other French news, Paris Saint-Germain have drawn again.
Yeah, so that's 2 draws in a row. So obviously won
What's
their first
on?
14 games of the season, setting a new record for Europe's 5 major leagues. And then they drew 2-2 against Bordeaux at the weekend, and then drew 1-1 at Strasbourg last night. And I think this is perhaps a consequence of That victory over Liverpool in the Champions League, which felt like a really important win for them. It was something, you know,
left them with hideous injuries as well, I think we all recall.
Yeah, oh, yes. I mean, took a proper battering as well. So you've got to factor that in. And I think this perhaps understandably been a bit of an emotional, sort of psychological.
Really? They better get themselves back together because they've got another big Champions League fixture coming up next week when they're away at Red Star Belgrade.
They do indeed. I mean, they Thomas Tuchel made quite a few changes at Strasbourg, which is quite a difficult place to go in general.
Transport-wise or just...
Just sort of like, you know, hostility, little ground, fans packed in, that sort of thing. Neymar missing through injury, Mbappe, Di Maria on the bench. And as often is the case, it took the introduction of Mbappe to spark PSG into some kind of life. He won a penalty that Cavani scored. So, yeah, PSG have lost a little bit of momentum. And also, they've had their home game against Montpellier this weekend postponed because of the ongoing Gilets Jaunes protests, which complicates things a little bit in view of that big game against Red Star Belgrade on Tuesday.
Italy, big match is Friday night as Juve take on Inter in the Derby d'Italia, the Beppe Marotta derby, if you will. We talk more about that in this week's Galazzo, but only after we've finished detailing the extraordinary career of Maurizio Zamperini down at Palermo, a man who brought the Sicilian side their greatest players and their greatest years, but also an extraordinary amount of upheaval on the bench and indeed off it.
An example of what the Italians call a coach eater, I believe.
A mangia allenatore, the ultimate example, because no other club owner has managed to do what he's done. A couple of highlights. He managed to fire a manager after a win twice in the same season. He also, in that same season, went through no less than 8 managerial changes. Remarkable. Anyway, Spain, it's the Catalan derby as Espanyol take on league leaders Barcelona, while in Madrid, it's the Superclásico, perhaps. My latest information on this, Tom, is that the second leg of River Plate against Boca Juniors is scheduled to take place on Sunday at the Bernabeu, 2-2, of course, from the first leg. But I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, there's still some uncertainty, isn't there? Or is there not? Is it all going ahead?
No, there seems to be some wrangling. No. Someone's objected to it. Is it River Plate have objected to it.
No news there. But,
I mean, whatever happens, there's not going to be a satisfying conclusion to this. Wherever the game takes place and whoever wins it, you know, this will be the Copa Libertadores that, you know, had to be delayed multiple times, you know, that had the attack on the Boca bus. You kind of just want them to get out of the way, really.
I've seen a few people up in arms about this, saying that it shouldn't be away from South America. But unless you're actually a Boca or River Plate fan, I think it's a great spectacle. I want to watch it now.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's more time-friendly for us, isn't it?
Well, yeah, except it might clash, I'm not sure of the timings, with the final of the MLS Cup.
Oh.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, I'll just Sky Plus, it's fine.
Oh, that's fair enough then. Okay, Atlanta will be taking on Portland in their ever-so-exciting Mercedes-Benz Stadium. The Five Stripes, as I like to call Atlanta, are making their first MLS Cup appearance in only, Duncan, their second year of existence. You've got to admit, that is remarkable.
It is remarkable.
The Timbers will be hoping to repeat history because, of course, they won MLS Cup in their first appearance in the game in 2015.
Are the Timbers the team who have the lumberjack man?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And there's some discussion about where they're going to put their log, if you'll excuse the expression, at the Mercedes-Benz.
Do they take the log? Yeah, they take it with them.
The goal scorer gets the. Does the goal scorer get the?
Gets the. I mean, maybe River and Boca should bring their own chainsaws to.
No, sort maybe out that way.
It's a great idea, and that is all the football. So let's get the odds on some of the weekend's games. Producer Ben has been speaking to Paddy Power.
Thank you, Jimbo. Lee Price from Paddy Power is on the line. And Lee, Jimbo has been telling us throughout the show that he's got a special feeling about Chelsea, that they're going to inflict the first defeat of the season on Pep and Man City. What are the numbers saying?
They are an all right price. They're 3-1, so you do fancy that as a decent price. City are odds on to win at Stamford Bridge 5-6, and the draw is 11-4. Hard to argue that, really.
And there's a money back special on this one too, I believe.
We do indeed, and this could be an excuse to back Chelsea at the massive 3-1 at home. It's money back as a free bet if Man City win. That applies to losing first, last, anytime goal scorers, correct score, and what odds Paddy markets. Max refund £10. T&Cs apply.
Sticking with Manchester versus London, Claudio Ranieri is going up against his old friend Jose Mourinho as Fulham take on Man United. Give us the odds on this one.
Yeah, a meeting of two Chelsea legends, two close friends, apparently, and two arch pragmatists. probably won't be one for the neutral this. United, we do favour. They are odds on somehow, 3-10. Fulham are a massive 17-2, and the draw's 4-1. More likely, I reckon. Mourinho tops the sack race betting at 15-8. No one else is anywhere near him. Nuno, weirdly, second favourite at 5-1, ahead of Dyche at 7-1, the same price as Neil Warnock. But Mourinho has got to win that. He might win something this season after all.
Rafa Honigstein's been telling us all about Ralph Rabbit. Hutch, what's going to go on, Lee, when Southampton take on Cardiff? And give us the relegation odds from both of these guys, please.
So Ralph Hasenhüttl was the man, as we decisively said on Monday's show, or not. Not a bad start for him, Cardiff, although it is away from home. Southampton are just about the favourites. They're 6-4. Cardiff 9-5. The draw's 21-10. We also favour Southampton in the relegation betting. They're 11-4 to go down. That's four favourites, as it were. Cardiff second favourites are 4-7. Burnley, the new odds on the favourites to go down at 1-3.
You can find out those odds and more at paddypower.com. All prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's 18 plus only. BeGambleAware.org. And when the fun stops, stop. Speaking of, what are the odds?
Yeah, weren't you hit on the head by something unusual?
Almost. It dropped to my feet about as I was making my way in to do Golazzo on Wednesday morning. I was walking along by the kind of the watery bit of Regent's Park, and there was a thud, and a large object had fallen right in front of me. And I looked at it thinking, what is it? Is it an enormous bird dropping? But then it wriggled. Its little legs went, and I was a bit perturbed by this. And I realised it was actually like a tiny little lobster creature, like a langoustine. And it was really...
These are the end times.
Well, you wonder, don't you? So I wandered on, then turned around thinking perhaps I should document this because people will never believe that I was almost hit on the head by a flying langoustine in Regent's Park. But the birds had already taken it away. And I surmise, my guess is that it was... there's a fishmonger up in St John's Wood, and almost certainly a bird, gull or otherwise, will have swooped down. David,
from a restaurant,
possibly. Yeah, but it was a live one, that was the thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it was on its back and its little legs were wriggling. Oh. I considered kicking it into the Regent's Park pond. I don't know what that would have done to the ecosystem.
Well, that'd be the fear, wouldn't it? You wouldn't want to be responsible for some giant mutant strain of langoustines
again.
Suddenly crawling over central London again. I mean,
but equally, when I turned around, because I did feel bad for the poor thing wriggling on its back, the birds had already got it. And I reckon that they dropped it because they do that with mollusks, don't they? They drop them from a height to break the shell.
Okay. Oh.
And then it probably got eaten alive. Okay. With its back broken.
I think if the bird had a bit more wherewithal, it would have darted inside and got one of those little lobster forks to go with it. Wouldn't have had to drop it on the path then, but
right,
might learn its lesson.
Perhaps. Maybe that's why you don't often see that happening, because usually they just use forks.
Yeah, there you go. That explains it.
Thanks, Tom. As I said at the time, probably not the strangest thing that's going to happen all week, but still, because, those are the times we live in. As I think producer Ben discovered... this week. Isn't that right, Tom?
Yeah, this week or last week. And he opened the door to some kind of tradesman. And the tradesman said, "Hello, is your mum in?" Thinking that Ben was a child, apparently.
Well, unless he was looking for, elderly relatives, in which
case... He was wearing a romper suit at the time, so it's possibly explicable.
What was the tradesman selling, I would have to ask? Oh, really? Patio power cleaning tools. Okay. That is a strange story and comfortably beats my langoustine anecdote, as most things probably will do. That's pretty much it then for today's show. Duncan, you're looking forward to the weekend's football?
Yep.
Okay, good. And which game are you going to pick?
I think we'll go for Chelsea.
You go for the Chelsea Man City. Yeah. It's going to be pivotal in the season when the history books are written. This will be the day they look at. David, what about you? Are you going somewhere fancy?
I am doing core comms on Arsenal Huddersfield.
Oh, yeah.
For international broadcast. So if you're outside the UK, listen in.
Oh, nice.
TalkSport 2.
Right, very good. By the way, listeners, if you've enjoyed listening to David Preece, and there was one listener who wrote in saying they were made up you were on today.
Oh, it's lovely that, isn't it?
It's not a made-up tweet, I have to say, but it sounds a little bit like it. But there is a place they can hear more of you.
There is. It's Graham Hunter's podcast, The Big Interview.
What do you talk about?
I talk about everything. I talk about Shakespeare, about The Merchant of Venice,
nice.
About my old English teacher, and amongst other things, Peter Schmeichel and Van der Sar, kind of where my analysis comes from. And I was... absolutely honoured to be asked to do it. When you look at the rest of the people that he's interviewed for this series, it was a real pleasure talking to him.
Oh, nice. Very good. And that's out at the moment. Tom?
I'm not going to Monte Carlo after all.
Oh, no.
The game's just been called off.
Can we not just pretend?
The game?
Oh, the game's called off.
Yeah.
Why? Because of the Yellow Jackets?
Because of the Gilets Jaunes. Oh. Even Monaco, even sleepy old Monte Carlo is not safe from the tyranny of the Gilets Jaunes, it would appear.
My word. And I'll just be kind of sat around, you know, watching the skies. Brilliant. Excellent. Do enjoy yourself and stay safe out there, listener. We will be back on Monday with Czech's Notes. Oh, we've got Sasha Gurionov in on Monday, and Ian Irving, and Michael Cox as well. So that's an eclectic and international panel to discuss the weekend's events. Have a great time in the meanwhile. We'll see you then.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. And don't forget to check out our other football shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand. Supporting your team can be a beautiful thing, but then come the injuries, the goal droughts, and the downright disastrous defeats. That's a little bit like life, really, and here at the Totally Football Show, we believe we should all support each other the way we support our team, through the good days and the bad. And that's why we're continuing to work with CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide. On average, 12 men take their own life every day in the UK, so that's your starting 11 and your manager every single day. And part of the problem is that many of us still feel uncomfortable talking about mental health and suicide, and this can often stop men from opening up and getting support when they need it the most. So if you're worried that someone close to you is having a tough time, check in with them and let them know that CALM is there. Every day from 5pm till midnight, CALM provide a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and web chat for any man who needs support. Visit thecalmzone.net to find out more about CALM.